Well, if Kilwanji was saying that it's pretty hard to up Satch, it's pretty hard to up you now. So let's see how this goes. Nubia. Somehow, whatever my topic is, I end up starting with Sheikh Anta Diop, because he kind of changed my life. He was a recognized Senegalese scientist, best known for his invention of carbon-14, or carbon dating. And he was the first African scientist to be nominated for a Nobel Prize. As early as 1954, he wrote a book titled Nation Nègre et Culture, in which he argued that the Egyptian pharaohs were black and that the civilization they created was an integral part of African heritage. He highlighted how for centuries European rulers intentionally made sure to exclude Egypt from the idea of what is Africa, and proceeded to attribute pharaonic heritage to white European civilization. This systematic inclusion of Egypt as part of the West's legacy, he argued, was a necessary precursor to the ensuing colonial adventure. After all, colonialism was founded on the idea of civilizing the barbarians. Accordingly, accepting that Egyptian civilization belonged to Africa was highly controversial. The polemic around the question whether Egyptians are racially white or black raged amongst Egyptologists throughout the 60s, but it finally came to a head at a conference organized by the UNESCO in Cairo in 1974. There, the top 20 world-renowned Egyptologists gathered for a week, and each camp tried to prove its claim scientifically. The conference, although little known, was a historic breakthrough. Sheikh Anta and the only other black man in the room, Professor Obenga from the Congo, came out of the conference triumphant. Based on scientific analysis of dosages of melanin, blood types, and bone tissue taken from the well-preserved mummies, as well as analysis of languages and text, it was finally concluded that both culturally and racially, ancient Egyptians were indeed black. They even analyzed some samples from modern Egyptians based on the same criteria and concluded that they too should be classified black. But did this scientific proof actually alter the way Egypt and its rulers see themselves after centuries of brainwashing? Not really. Until today, he looks more green than black, but he is black. Until today, there's a kind of schizophrenia whereby Egyptians from the north take pride in their ancient history and acknowledge that Nubians, the inhabitants of the south of Egypt, were the founders of pharaonic civilization. Yet they look down on the country's black population and pile onto them the worst injustices and actively engage in erasing their cultural heritage. Nubian culture has been under siege, not by the colonial powers or by foreign invaders, but rather by their fellow Egyptians in the north. Since 1902, the Nubian people underwent four waves of displacement and resettlement to make way for dams on the River Nile in 1902, 1912, 1933, culminating in the construction of the Aswan High Dam in 1964, which submerged all of the ancient homeland on either side of the Egyptian and Sudanese borders.
Aswan was very exciting. We had walked through the enormous tunnels, and we were the last humans to do so because they would be totally immersed in the new course of the River Nile.
Okay, on this day in 1963, Lake Nasser, or Lake Nubia, became one of the largest man-made lakes in the world. The lake covers a total of 5,250 square kilometers. What we don't see in the video clip with Nasser and Khrushchev in this moment of political triumph, which is basically his biggest achievement towards development and modernity, between parentheses, is the displacement of almost 100,000 Nubians on both sides of the border from their ancestral land along the fertile banks of the River Nile. In January 1960, Nasser visited Nuba. It was his first visit, and he arrived in a brand new helicopter, and the cheers were spectacular, and the crowds hailed him as a savior. The Nubians believed that the popular young president would finally sort out their long-awaited compensation from the three previous displacements. Since 1933, out of the hundreds of Nubian villages, only over 50 remained, and today only a handful of traditional villages exist. And the ones that do exist only exist because they were built initially on top of the hills. And in 1960, the previously displaced had rebuilt temporary homes along the shores of the Nile based on a decree, because basically, in these different displacements, everybody promised compensation, but the key thing was that in 1933, the king told the Nubians, you can build anywhere and the land would be yours. That became a problem. So when Nasser arrived in Nubia, there was a lot of hope, and the unsuspecting Nubians assembled in Aswan near the ancient flooded monuments. The flooded monuments, and they even had a ceremonial Nubian ancestral traditional welcome for the president. There you go. And there, he gave the speech that was supposed to change the destiny.
I go in at the lock. And yes, I know all the third minkum. And Anna. نعامل أبناء هذه الأمة معاملة واحدة مبنية على الحق والحرية والمساواة.
Basically, he's saying, I hope that every one of you feels that we are treating the people of this nation equally in terms of rights and freedoms, and that as we dig the high dam, it will bring prosperity not only to the north, but it will not rob you, the Nubians, of the benefits and the prosperity to come. But of course, once the flooding started, that very speech, the ramifications of it were tremendous. And Nubians today, so basically, just a second before we do this, basically what I did is that I went to the very place where the speech was given, and these two people were actually children the day of the evacuation, And they remembered listening to the speech that that they had on their phone. And it was very interesting to capture that sound. And they took me to the temple just next to where Nasser gave the speech. And then you'll hear, after that, you'll hear the feedback recording that, sorry, Sach, but I have to say soundscape, to capture, to try and capture within the temple that character of the space where it was. So there we go. They were in that space when they were listening to the recording. The only word that was said amongst them was, "Weren't we naive?" Can you put there?
This is it. This is it.
Somehow it doesn't sound as eerie here as it was in the temple. that temple was flooded. That is Abu Simbel before they started to raise it and all of that. So basically, the Aswan High Dam in Egypt's national discourse remains until today the pillar of Egypt's vision of development, modernity, and prosperity. It is the country's pride, proof that Egypt succeeded to build its post-colonial future despite all attempts to block it. Accordingly, Nubian plight is erased from any official discourse. The impact of the flooding and the subsequent destruction of Nubian social and family structures, the exclusion of the Nubian language, culture, and the way of life continues to go unrecognized as the national, on both the national and the international level. But then why is it that someone like Gamal Abdel Nasser, a champion of Pan-Africanism, why did he just, he didn't even hesitate to destroy the culture and the homeland of his own country's black population? It's basically this unitary fiction of Egypt's Arab identity that was intentionally cultivated by the ideology of Arab nationalism in the post-colonial period, which effectively excluded minority identities from Egyptian national imaginary. I would argue here that it even started the erosion of not only the ethnic, but also the religious pluralism in Egypt. Non-recognition of ethnic minorities at the national level was accompanied by strategies of sedentization, assimilation, Arabization of minorities, and Arabic became the only language that could be written. So Nubian language, which is still spoken today, but less and less, there used to be an alphabet, and there were like 5-6 old people that remain that can still read the Arab the alphabet, which is a combination apparently of Russian, Greek, and Amharic. Very few symbols of it remain. And so the mechanism of cultural erasure began based on the idea of a strong, unified Arab nation that would be modern and secular and confront the continued neo-colonial or imperial designs of post-independence. The building of the Aswan High Dam was a central part of this new modern Egypt. And the developmental fantasy of a benign redemptive dam continues. The result has been a collective national amnesia towards the experience of dispossession and displacement of entire segments of the population whose homes and histories have been drowned and go unmourned in the Egyptian national consciousness. So, but despite all of this, the Nubian culture has survived the disappearance of the physical space. And music, specifically, has been the way of resisting that erasure of Nubian culture. Artists have consciously worked to keep memory alive and transit and transmit. Sorry, I'm really tired. I've just gone through 40 hours of flying, so. So anyway, to transmit to the next generation. So the iconic music of someone like Hamza Alaeddin that started in like the early 60s was this accumulation of trying to keep that culture alive, but was finally captured in that music, which obtained the name of the music of return. But before playing, I want to play the same song 3 different times, recorded in 3 different eras. But before doing that, there's a little anecdote that I think was really important in how the survival of Nubian culture became really a key element in Egyptian history. While President Anwar al-Sadat was preparing for the 1973 war, secrecy was his biggest problematic. The answer to his dilemma came from a Nubian soldier who suggested to his commander to use the unwritten and dying Nubian language as the code or cipher for the army command. Sadat found the idea brilliant, but worried that not many Nubians even spoke the language anymore. A hunt for a young man who still spoke the ancestral language started, and 35 Egyptian Nubians were recruited into the Signals Corps of the army. And basically, the code for the 1973 war, in the cipher of the code, was done in Nubian language. And so after the peace treaty was signed with Israel in 1977, the Israelis admitted that the Nubian code became their biggest problem because Nobody could teach the language, nobody knew the language, and so nobody could decipher it. Ahmed Idris, who is the Nubian soldier who did the code, the cipher, was finally rewarded by a medal for his great service for the homeland in 2014, from 1973 to 2014. And it was the 44th anniversary of the victory of the October War. This recognition was a step, and a very timid step, by the Egyptian government to try and grapple with its marginalized population, or should I say grapple with Egypt's marginalized African heritage. Voila. And so the song that, first of all, the video clip, it's called Abayasa, and this was recorded in the 60s with a archive depiction that was only released much later through the Nubian community that are starting to mobilize since 2011.
أبياتا أبا تذكروا والشوس دار لنا يا أبياتا أبا تذكروا والشوس دار لنا يا نوبة ملنيتو شرطين تونكو نوستو كاف البلا اوكين جرا كاف البلا اوكين جرا واي واي شرطي الفايا في ما منكونا فيا في ونوبتو ملنيتو أبياتا أفكر وشوكا رولينيا أبياتا أفكر وشوكا رولينيا
موادي. This next one I'm particularly fond of because it's this was in the late 70s. Ahmed Munib, who's a very, the Nubian legend, is with a very young Mohammed Munir, who is now like the very well-known pop, the only singer of Nubian pop. Not only Nubian, he's a very well-known Egyptian singer. And the song basically is talking about we will return despite everything and our culture will survive. Just a little bit to see it.
Oh,
Okay, his final one is in the house where I was staying in Luba when I went to record, where absolutely everyone I met had that as his ringtone. That's why I decided to use that song. And voila, I'll leave you with this final Abayasa.